You know that if you turn the dial on your radio and on your TV set and on every news story, it has the same slant and it's the same stories. You know that the news and the media are controlled. If you don't, you're not playing with a full deck of cards. Okay? It is absolutely absurd to believe that all these different networks, news stations, newspapers, and radio stations are all owned by different people, yet they all carry the exact same stories every day, worded in the exact same way, with the same agenda and the same slant. You see, if they were all separate and independent, that could never happen in a million years because no two people ever attach the same importance to the same event or the same slant on the same story unless they're handed it.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, again, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers by the skin of his teeth, managing to re-find his Skype password. A bomb in the second hour in Beirut Harbour, or is it an accident? We discussed this enormous blast on Tuesday, which destroyed Lebanon's ability to trade. Deliberate or accident? And what if we've been lied to about the dangers of radiation? The Fukushima, ever since the models still do use today, which were created around the time of the Hiroshima blast. So this is the 75th anniversary of Hiroshima Day. We talked this week to Chris Busby, Dr. Chris Busby, about what he believes is the failed and flawed model for measuring the dangers of nuclear power plants today based on events at Hiroshima. And that, of course, includes Hinkley C. Plus, more on what the mass media are not telling you, such as the extraordinary release of the Ghislaine Maxwell court papers, which John Paul Rice from Hollywood, he's a producer, never mind the Me Too movement, he believes it exposes an evil paedophile ring in Hollywood, which he has witnessed as part of his work too, and he talks about that. Also, Bulgarian investigative journalist Ileana Gatasheva, she speaks in an exclusive interview to me this week. We heard from her last week about the biowarfare labs of the Pentagon. She speaks this week about her discovery of the arms pipeline to the so-called Syrian rebels. That's all in the second hour after six. But before all that, we revisit a story this programme covered way back in 2017. Now, the reason we're covering it in more depth is, or should be, clear. I couldn't use the most sensitive parts of the interview back in 2017 with Balogun, the St. Paul's-based human rights and anti-apartheid activist, because the BCFM station manager, Pat Hart, who's a friend of our present mayor, Marvin Rees, instructed me not to. Even what we used at the time, which was both legally sound and most definitely in the public interest, earned me a 3-week suspension by Pat Hart from the airwaves. So before we go back on FM and under Pat Hart's editorial control there, it makes sense to clear the air on this story. We heard last week about the death of St. Paul's illegal drug and drinking den owner Ajax. This week we go down Ashley Road to Grosvenor Road to give you a fuller picture of an alleged black-on-black attack at the height of the successful campaign, previously anyway, against apartheid, which was being run by one of St. Paul's firebrands, that's Ras Kumba Jahili Balogun, and an incident in 1997 where he alleges the present mayor Marvin Rees's father Valentine Walker, who owned a similar illegal drug and drinking club on the junction of Grosvenor Road and St Nicholas Road called the Crystal Dove. We hear tonight a refresher on Bristol's role in the 1980s resistance to apartheid and the Thatcher government, a regional news story also about Chief Constable Malcolm Popperwell, which made it into almost all the national newspapers, and the present mayor Marvin Rees's father's alleged attempt to kill Balogun and his trial for assault against Balogun. We also hear for the first time from Avonmouth activist Steve Norman, who subsequently died, and his assessment that the present Bristol mayor Marvin Rees was given special privileges at the time, even sent to Harvard University, eventually becoming mayor of Bristol because of what his father Valentine Walker did for the establishment. After I approached him in 2017 through the BCFM station manager Pat Hart, Valentine Walker, who now lives in Streatham, London, left a note for me in the BCFM studio 6 months ago, over 2 years later, purporting to be his phone number. Around the 7th of February, that happened a few weeks before our show was taken off FM. Was it a friendly gesture or an attempt to intimidate? How did Valentine Walker get access to our BCFM studio? Valentine replied to my call and my text by text a couple of weeks later, or a week or so later, on Valentine's Day, saying he might come and see me next time he was in Bristol. Well, I thanked him, looking forward to it, but I've heard nothing since. So if anyone knows Valentine, including station manager Pat Hart, do please let him know. I'm happy for him to tell his side of the story of the attack on Balagoon, alleged, of the trial, and of the accusations of being a police informer. As yet, I've heard nothing more from Valentine Walker, so I'll be airing the full story from Balagoon and Steve Norman's perspective tonight. The context is Valentine's 1987 alleged attempt to kill Balagoon and what Balagoon is doing now after being driven out of St. Paul's in the 1980s, living in Ghana. And the sacking also we'll be hearing about in the first hour of Dr. Mohamed Adil for, amongst other things, objecting at the time to the release of hospital patients to care homes, amongst other things. Also, he's claiming that the virus is not as dangerous as the government and mass media keep telling us he is. It is, even though he's been working in the NHS as a top consultant and even a registrar for 35 years, he's just been sacked as a doctor and he cannot now work in Britain. In order to make a living, he will have to go back to Pakistan. Anyway, Martin Summers, Irish Republican Labour activist, can you sum up your own thoughts and feelings about this event back in the 1980s in St. Paul's? Because at the time, there was quite a lot of very successful anti-apartheid activism going on. For example, one of the things I've heard anecdotally is that one night, on a Sunday night, 12 branches of Barclays Bank were attacked and they had their front windows smashed in the city all in the same night. And this is the bank that was dealing with South Africa. And that actually didn't get reported in the 1980s in the press at all.
Well, I can't say I've got first-hand knowledge of what was going on in Bristol in the 1980s. I was living in Brixton at the time, so I know what was going on there. And so far as anybody does, you know, just living somewhere doesn't mean you know what's going on. And I'm familiar with the story because obviously we've covered it before. You know, I wait to hear what you've got to offer.
Anyway, I thought we'd start with a recording of Steve Norman talking about something different. Just to introduce Steve, he died about 18 months ago, but Steve was a very, shall we say, a bit of a firebrand, a bit like Balagoon in a way, an activist. He was a former member of the Seamen's Union and an activist within the Merchant Navy. And Steve Norman, here he is talking about Terence Mordaunt and David Ord. These are these two merchant venturers who were so very powerful down at the Bristol port. And, of course, the former merchant venturer who then became mayor, George Ferguson, sold the port, sold the city's interest in the port to the Bristol Port Company for what Steve thought was actually a very small amount of money. So let's have a listen now to Steve talking about Bristol Port, which is where he lived down in Avonmouth.
They've got all the workshops, all the machinery, 2,600 and something acres of land, pockets of land all over Avonmouth.
2,000, that's a lot of land.
Yeah.
2,600 acres. If I don't know how I ought to be able to do my sums in my head, but you're talking, I would say for land like this, at the bare minimum, something like 50,000 an acre, maybe more, 100,000 an acre.
It would be more because Avonmouth's expanded under the South West Development Partnership. So as you go out from where we are stood now and go towards Seven Beach, where you had all the chemical works, ICI and what have you, you've got, they own pockets of land down there. Now, there are pockets of land, like on Cabot Park, that have been selling small, a couple of acres for 8 million, 9 million quid.
So, okay, we got a bad deal, I think.
We got a very bad deal, and the merchant venture's got a very good deal.
So that's Steve Norman there. Martin, also, we'll be hearing a bit more from him later, but can you just put this whole thing into context? The anti-apartheid struggle was really only one of various struggles that were going on in the 1980s under Margaret Thatcher. We also had the miners' strike. We had Wapping, We had the Battle of the Beanfield. It was a very tumultuous decade, which these events we're going to be talking about again in a minute were set up against, isn't it? Wasn't it?
It is, and it's also very important because it set the trend for what subsequently happened. I mean, things like the sale of council houses have created the and then the collapse of social housing provision have created a massive homelessness crisis, and that was all seeded in the 1980s. Thatcher's main crimes, in my view, were privatisation of things that shouldn't have been privatised, like the railways, which are subsequently coming back into public ownership, where they should always have been. The deregulation of the City of London in 1987, which led directly to the crash in 2008. And the third strand of wrong of which she did was the creation of Al-Qaeda and its training and arming by our own intelligence services. Nobody disputes that that's what happened. The story is that on 9/11, the people we'd trained and armed with our special forces and intelligence support turned on us and blew up the Twin Towers. That's rubbish. But of course, it was the Operation Cyclone that Margaret Thatcher was an enthusiastic participant in, which created the Islamist International Brigades, which we now claim to be scouring the planet to defeat, even though in actual fact, as we're going to hear in the second half, we've been arming them much more recently than the 1980s.
Yeah, the miners' strike was a big one, wasn't it? Because this is really about the country's energy supply. Whether or not you think that coal is a suitable thing now, certainly there's very few people now that think that coal's a good idea. So we're in a bizarre situation, aren't we, where most Labour members, most Labour MPs, certainly, you know, the shadow front bench and probably quite a lot of the other Greens and Tories too, now could look back at the miners' strike, Martin, and say, well, that was a good thing because it saved us from climate change.
No, well, I think the real issue in the miners' strike was the breaking of the trade unions. The NUM were the strongest union in Britain. And they basically, if you're going to run down an industry like coal, there's no reason to go at it like a bull at a gate. You gradually phase it out so that you limit the social impact. But there was an executive decision at the top. It was basically revenge for the two miners' strikes of 1972 and 1974, which basically, you know, boxed in the Tory government and defeated them. And there was, you know, from that moment on, there was a determination by the deep state in this country to break the NUM.
So am I right in thinking that the chief executive of British Coal at the time was an American, and also that there was infiltration of the National Union of Mine Workers right into the very centre of Arthur Scargill's committees?
Yeah, well, I mean, they brought over McGregor because he got a reputation for breaking unions in the US. He broke in the US miners' union at the AMAX coal combine in Kentucky. So it was quite clear what he was there for. And of course, Roger Windsor had infiltrated himself into the NUM and eventually made himself indispensable to Arthur Scargill. Arthur Scargill should have been smarter about that than he was, but there you go. And of course, he was the one who basically arranged the so-called trip to Libya to ask Gaddafi for money. And it's all in Seamus Milne's book, The Enemy Within, how close the NUM actually came to victory. And at one stage, apparently, Thatcher was in tears in a cabinet meeting because they were definitely going to lose. But they managed, in the end, to scrape it. I mean, I remember when NACODs, which are the supervisors, were balloted if they'd come out on strike. If they came out on strike, that would have been a complete close down of the coal industry. But they didn't do that. And of course, because they didn't, eventually it all went the other way. But you've got to remember how contingent history actually is. The idea that they were doomed to defeat is wrong. There were various mistakes made. But if they'd won, then we'd probably be living in a different country today than the one we are living in.
Yeah, there's another aspect to all of this. I mean, I mentioned these three, you know, the two strikes, the printer workers' strikes, the miners' strike, and also the Battle of the Beanfield with the Traveller Peace Convoy being smashed the year after. Then there also, in 87, there was the dismemberment of the BBC, that is to say Seamus Milne's father, Alastair Milne, being removed as Secretary General by Victor Rothschild, who himself was very much involved, if you read Spycatcher and other books, in determining who was in charge of the security services. So this does seem as if Margaret Thatcher, to a large extent, handed quite a lot of power over those years to the security services to infiltrate and use dirty tricks to get her way.
Yeah, well, we know that from the 1960s onwards, the left in this country was systematically infiltrated, and all the stone paranoia that people used to get into, like, we're being infiltrated. We now know that that was true.
Well, they may have been branded as conspiracy theorists.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point about all of this, of course, is to create distrust and make it virtually impossible for people to organise politically and to fragment any opposition. And that's been going on continuously.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, you're talking there about creating a kind of hostile environment for democratic politics.
Yeah, well, I mean, the state doesn't just sit on its hands, and the corporate interests that the state represents don't just sit on their hands when people organise against them. And, we've had an armed struggle within the borders of this state, not just strikes, not just breaking windows in Barclays Bank. We've had two Tory prime ministers nearly assassinated by the Provisional IRA. So, this country has got a tradition of political conflict. It's, people may think of it as some kind of backwater in terms of things like that, but it never has been and it still isn't.
Okay, so anyway, let's re-examine this story from a couple of years ago, going much more deeply into it today than we were able to do under the editorship of Pat Hart from BCFM and also at the time. So we'll start off really by having an extract from the interview with Balogun that I did from Ghana back in 2017, really putting this into context. What was going on in Bristol in the 1980s and then what was Bristol's anti-apartheid role?
Bristol was on the map because when Nelson Mandela was eventually released from prison, I was given an invitation immediately to go and meet him in a hotel in West London, where I brought all my family and other activists from other parts of the country. We all gathered there and met Nelson and Winnie Mandela and Tambo and the rest of them. So Bristol was on the map, and Bristol was clearly on the map because the St. Paul's Apartheid Free Zone campaign was an initiative that I went around the country with and established apartheid-free zones in Toxteth, in Moss Side, in Handsworth, in Hyson Green, in Brixton, all across the country. It wasn't just an apartheid-free zone in Bristol. I went up and down the country and established apartheid-free zones on the same premise that they were organized here, organized there in Bristol. So Bristol was indeed on the map. And with the work that I did with the Labour Party, I spoke at Labour Party conference, moving motions at Labour Party conference. I was chairman of the Labour Party black sections, where we got the four MPs elected eventually, Diane Abbott, Keith Vaz, Paul Boateng, and Bernie Grant, who has since passed away. I was instrumental in those people being elected. Instrumental. Bristol was instrumental. I wasn't just the only person travelling from Bristol to London for black section meetings or other Labour Party meetings. There were other black people as well that were involved.
Yeah, so that's Balogun, the St. Paul's-based anti-apartheid activist. Martin, I mean, it does sound as if Bristol was playing a pretty important role there, and certainly from the Thatcher government's point of view, from the South African government's point of view, from the racists' point of view, that the activists in this city were going to be a target.
Quite likely, yeah. And, of course, Balogun first came to prominence because Bristol, St. Paul's, was where the big riots of 1981 began. So it started in St. Paul's. I was living in Brixton at the time. It spread to Brixton the next day. And then on the third day, it spread to Liverpool. So Bristol went first in that wave of...
Okay, he does talk about exactly what sparked those riots back in 81 in the interview I did with him. I'll put a full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk once this program's been uploaded, probably about 9 or 10 o'clock this evening. But let's go on now to hear the accusations that, I mean, in fact, this is a story that came out initially to the local press, but it very quickly spread all over the nationals about the chief constable of Avon and Somerset Police, a guy in the 1980s called Malcolm Popperwell.
Malcolm Popperwell was a chief superintendent who led a racist drug raid into the community, I think in 1987. And he led that raid around the time where we were picking the kids from school. So you had grandfathers who were coming to pick their grandchildren, of course, mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers. And basically they made a big swoop in St. Paul's and just arrested everybody inside on the basis that they believed that they were either taking drugs or selling drugs. And obviously the drug, the main drug was cannabis. Basically, they had to release a lot of people because at the end of the day, these were just people who were just coming from school and picking their siblings and what have you. Now, I brought a lot of pressure to bear on Malcolm Popperwell, and eventually he had an heart attack. I think within 72 hours he had a heart attack. I was out on the front line, as it was called, then Grosvenor Road, and somebody, I don't know who it was, but we were talking, and somebody said, oh, we hope the bastard dies. So I picked the phone up, and I think it's the Evening Post I gave a call to, one of the reporters there. I had good rapport with the journalists back in those days, and they were always gunning for a good controversial story to sell their newspapers. And I just told them that this is, you know, Kwame Jai Balogun here, and on behalf of the black community, we hope that Malcolm Popperwell dies. Now, the next morning, I had the real paparazzi outside the house. I didn't know it had blown up that big. I was front page of every single British newspaper on that day. I opened the front door and the flash from the camera was just going, and I quickly shut the door and made a phone call and said, I've got all these photographers outside. And someone said, haven't you seen the papers? And I said, no. I said, you're front page. Hope the bastard dies. So eventually, I decided that I've got to go out there, jump in the car, and go to the newspaper shop. And I got up there on to City Road. I told the guy, oh, let me have every single newspaper. I could see my picture on every single newspaper. And I bought every single one and went to the community association where my office was. Now, politically, it probably wasn't the right thing to be done. When you talk about political correctness. But my allegiance was to the black community. It wasn't to the establishment. It wasn't to the institutions that did their best to criminalize us, you know, and put a 6 foot six in the grave. It was to the black community. And I echoed what the black community felt. And I didn't realize the implications of it, of course. I was naive with that statement, but once again, it's one of those things that I would do again. I've got no problem.
So that's Balogun speaking to me about 2.5 years ago. And now we get to the point which is the part of the interview which I couldn't air at the time, partly because of the pressure from Pat Hart, the station manager, but also, of course, because it contradicts the results of a court case which took place at the time. Martin, the idea of broadcasting one side of the story might seem, I mean, this is after, remember, well, long, long after this court case is finished, is surely it's okay. I mean, what I've done is I've approached Valentine Walker directly and asked him, and he doesn't want to give his point of view. So it just seems to me that we've got to give the point of view which we've already recorded with Balogun.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're online now and the rules are a bit different. You know, Ofcom does not regulate what we're doing at the moment. So let's hear what he's got to say.
Well, I mean, I'm saying more than that, really. I'm saying, well, we have a duty to report this stuff one way or another. And of course, there are certain caveats you'd have. This is most clearly Balogun's specific personal point of view. But I just want to make it absolutely clear that I have approached Valentine, first of all, through Pat Hart, and then directly in order to try and get his point of view. He doesn't seem to want to give his point of view, rather other than leave a little note for me in February in the BCFM studio on the table with his number, and then really not get back to me. And I think it might be good before we hear this, just to hear the actual article which appeared, or one of the articles which appeared about the court case that transpired after this incident. And that was published on April the 9th, 1988, in The Guardian. I believe the incident took place at the end of 1987. The headline is, "Community Worker is Cleared of Machete Attack on Rastafarian." So a jury yesterday cleared a, there's no actual byline on this, a jury yesterday cleared a community worker on charges of attacking Rastafarian Mr. Koumba Balogun with a machete. Earlier, Mr. Balogun, aged 26, was fined £150 by the judge at Bristol Crown Court for turning up late on the second day of his trial. He wasn't on trial. Mr. Justice Smithies told his counsel, Mr. Ian Glenn, a fine would be a proper way of expressing public disapproval. So Smithies is the trial judge. The judge also ordered Mr. Balogun to pay £100 towards his defence costs, but Mr. Glenn said he did not intend to claim them. The jury found Mr. Valentine Walker, aged 36, of Robertson Road, Eastern Bristol, not guilty of unlawfully wounding Mr. Balogun with intent. So it wasn't an attempted murder charge or manslaughter. It was, the charge was unlawfully wounding with intent. An alternative charge of unlawful wounding was also dismissed. The prosecution claimed that Mr. Walker, former vice chairman of the St. Paul's Community Association, so that's Valentine, was former vice chairman of the St. Paul's Community Association, of which Mr. Balogun's now chairman, had stuck a 2-foot 6-inch machete into Mr. Balogun's neck. Mr. Mark Horton, prosecuting, said the blow came within 1 centimetre of severing his jugular vein. Now that makes it quite clear, and this is me, not the article, saying that it came very close to dying as a result of that. Obviously, if it had severed his jugular vein, he probably wouldn't still be alive today, Balogun. Okay, so the court was carrying on with the article. The court was told Mr. Balogun did not initially report the incident to the police and discharged himself from the Bristol Royal Infirmary after treatment. In his address to the jury, Mr. Nicholas O'Brien, who was defence counsel for Valentine Walker, said, "Mr. Balogun is an evil man who does not share society's standards or values. Mr. Walker did not appear during the 2-day hearing. The judge said that an arrest warrant still stood, but was now with bail, so that he would not have to be immediately arrested when found." So that's the article from The Guardian of the 9th of April, 1988. Now let's hear from Balogun himself and his account of the attack on him.
"The people who didn't like what I was doing in St. Paul's was the establishment, pure and simple. It was the establishment. They worked through people like Valentine Walker. He was a known informer. Let me tell you, quite straight. He was a known informer in the area. He was telling the police about various people who were doing this, who were doing that.
Do you have any evidence for that?
No, but I'm still saying it. I didn't go with him when he met with police officers and what have you, but it's not going to stop me from saying it. I said it when we even went to trial on this issue that we're going to discuss now. So, I knew him to be a police informer, and lots of people in our community knew him to be a police informer. And in fact, things were going so well in the community. I'd organized the community so well to the point where if I said, yes, let's go and demonstrate at Avon County Council, we'd get hundreds. If I said, let's demonstrate at Bristol City Council, we'd get hundreds. If I said, let's have a vigil on St. Paul's Green, we'd get hundreds. It was disturbing to the establishment. It was something that disturbed them. There were lots of single issue based campaigns. I mean, we did vigils to support the apartheid struggle in South Africa, for example. We did vigils when they were going to execute people in South Africa. We did, and lots of different things. There were lots of issues there. I organized St. Paul's Apartheid Free Zone, where we got all the shops to stop stocking and selling goods that was South Africa. That took a time. I closed down the Barclays Bank that was on Newfoundland Road. We used to picket it every Wednesday. You'd get about 30 or 40 people, and we used to stand in the queue. And when it got to our turn, we used to say stuff like, you know, we don't want any more blood money in South Africa. Leave South Africa. Then we disrupted the business every Wednesday of Barclays Bank. We used to do sittings in there. The police used to come, used to lift us out and put us on the pavement outside, and we used to just go back in. The bank couldn't cope with it. Eventually, they closed the building, you know. They closed that institution in St. Paul's. So the establishment was so upset with what was going on that they had to find a way to destabilize the community, and they did with the introduction of cocaine. And they introduced cocaine, hard drugs, through people like Valentine Walker. You know, these were the people who first came into the community with cocaine. I didn't even know what it was. I didn't know what heroin was, but it was mainly the cocaine. And they brought the cocaine into our community, destabilizing everything, and then they were able to pick people off. There was no unity again. We were fighting against each other.
Okay, and tell us about this altercation with Valentine and how it, you know, what transpired afterwards.
Well, he came into my office because I had another office called the St. Paul's Local Development Agency, and that was sponsored by the Tory government. They gave me £100,000 a year to establish black businesses. It was something that was supported by Prince Charles. It was his trust. And basically, I was running that agency, and I was assisting young African Caribbean men and women in establishing, you know, SMEs, small medium enterprises. And I was in that office one morning when Valentine Walker came in with a gun and started, you know, talking about, oh, you think you're the big boss in the area, and I'm going to show you, and all this kind of stuff, and what have you.
When was this?
Probably 87, even 87, I would say. But he came in with his gun. I was sitting behind my desk upstairs and, you know, started waving the gun about, you know, what I'm going to do to you and all this kind of stuff and what have you. And then he left, you know. I called a friend and told a friend that, look, this guy just came up, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we decided, okay, you know, hold tight, sit tight. And we'll take it from there.
Well, didn't you not think? Did you not think to phone the police?
Oh, come on! What would the police do? The police are the people who sent him. They sent him. I called the police and told them what the guy you sent to come and kill me has actually arrived. What would they do? They wouldn't do anything. The police were totally against me. So he came back, and he came back with a machete, which is a rather long knife that is used in the Caribbean. It's used for weeding and what have you, you know, it's used in Africa and stuff like that. And he made a swipe at me and cut my fingers because I put my hand up to protect myself. And then he went again as if he was coming to hack me. And then he changed the stroke halfway through and pushed it in my throat. When he withdrew the blade, obviously, a lot of blood just splattered out, and he ran out of the room saying, you can tell your friends, blah, 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 I'll be waiting. So anyway, to be honest with you, I traveled to Northern Ireland, and they taught me a number of things. And one of the things they taught me is whenever you get a wound, just take it easy. Don't start panicking. Just take your time, cool the adrenaline down, so you can control the amount of blood that's going to leave your body. And that's exactly what I did. I took my time, I walked to the bathroom, I saw the extent of the damage, I held both the skin together at my throat, and took my time and came downstairs and went to the shop next door and asked them to call the ambulance for me. And then I sat on the windowsill there and just waited. The ambulance came in about 3 minutes. But the nature of the cut was so severe that before I got to the hospital, they'd stitched it all up. Of course, they had the police coming round, who did it, what was this, this and that, blah, blah, blah. There was a lot of pressure because I had the locals in the community saying, don't say anything, we'll deal with it on our own. I had, you know, the politicians from the Labour Party saying, you must be seen to be using the system, and the system must be seen to be assisting you. So don't deal with it on your own. Tell the police everything. And, you know, it was a very traumatic time. I was released from the hospital. I don't know how much stitches I had. The friends came round, politicians came round. We all had a talk. And I tried to make a compromise by doing both things, which was telling the police eventually who it was, and then also trying to deal with it on my own. I told the police, and Valentine Walker didn't waste any time. He left the country and went to Jamaica, and he stayed there throughout the entire trial, because there was a trial. And
what, you mean his own trial?
Yeah.
So he was on trial even though he was in Jamaica?
Yeah. I think he must have turned up once to court or something. And I told the court that, yes, this is the guy that did it. And
was he at any point arrested?
Yeah, he was arrested. He was eventually arrested. He was arrested. And that's how, we, you know, the charges came up against him and what have you. But at the end of the day, he probably attended court once or twice, and then he fled to Jamaica. And in his absence, he was found not guilty. And it was determined that I'd cut my throat myself and blamed it on him because I was saying he was a police informant. Now, that was totally, absolutely unbelievable. But that's the way it went. You know, I wanted to accept it like that. Soon he was back in the community doing what he was doing. I was still there doing what I was doing as well. And I just had to live with it like that.
I mean, did you pass him in the street, that sort of thing?
No, not often. He travelled with, he moved around with a couple of other guys. And on one occasion that I was going to sort something out, something else happened and it deterred the whole thing. So basically, he got away with that. And, you know, I've just had to live with that.
I mean, so what with the introduction of cocaine and this incident as well, which seems like on the surface anyway is a miscarriage of justice, how did that affect the cohesion of the community in St. Paul's?
Well, the cocaine totally destroyed the cohesion in the community, totally destroyed, because we hadn't known anything about that before. We were just smoking cannabis. That was about it.
So I mean, how does the drug affect? How does the drug affect people in a political way?
Well, they began to feel that there was no hope. There was no point pursuing things politically at all. They even told me they felt I was barking up the wrong tree. It would be a waste of time and good energy. No one was going to listen to you. No one's going to take you seriously. No one was going to address the issue of poor housing, poor education, poor health care, you know, lack of employment, lack of, you know, recreational facilities. No one was going to address those things anymore because nobody cared. All they wanted for us was to be locked up in Lockleys prison. And that's what was happening. And when the cocaine came into the community, it swiftly turned people against each other, because once people got hooked on it, that was it. They were selling everything just to get a hit. And they were taking, you know, a rock on credit, stuff like that. And when they couldn't pay, then whoever you took it from came down on you like a sledgehammer coming to smash a nut. So, you know, the cohesion was totally destroyed. People became disillusioned once again, apathetic once again, and they didn't realize that they had a reason for living, you know. So it was very, very bad. It was a very, very bad situation. And I don't believe that St. Paul's has even recovered from that, because we've had a lot of black-on-black violence. We've had a lot of people who've been killed, and and what have you. And, you know, the area has been gentrified now, and black people are being driven from St. Paul's because it's next door to the town centre, and black people essentially have been dispersed. And they congregate now in pubs here and there and what have you. And the type of cohesion we had back in the early 80s, I don't think that will ever return to St. Paul's again.
Well, that's Balagoon, you interviewed 18 months ago. Martin, you know, it's sort of amazing, I think, to listen back to this. And in a way, the heart of what he's saying there, and that part of the interview is the one we couldn't air earlier because of, well, potentially, basically because the station manager didn't want us to. But, I mean, the thing is, at the end of the day, you know, when there is a miscarriage of justice, at least apparent miscarriage of justice like this, you do have to talk about it with the people involved. And it's quite clear that Valentine Walker hasn't wanted to be, he's the other side of this story, hasn't wanted to be, and I would still encourage Valentine, if he's listening to this, do get in touch. We want to hear your version of events. But what he's describing there, Martin, is really the smashing and demoralisation of an extremely active political community.
Yeah. I mean, just leaving aside the specific allegations, because obviously that depends upon what specifically happened and who's telling the truth. But it's quite clear that the introduction of crack cocaine in particular in the late 1980s in Britain and in the US caused all kinds of problems. And we now know in the US there's a film called Dark Alliance, which is based on the investigations of Gary Webb, who was based in California, that the CIA, through the Nicaraguan Contras and Adolfo Carrero, were bringing in massive amounts of cocaine into the inner cities in the US in that era, because it demoralized the local community, as there's a police officer,
Mike Rupert, don't you?
Mike Rupert also investigated
He stood up to John Deutsch, who was the CIA director.
People can find this on YouTube. Mike Rupert, who was a LAPD police officer, stands up at a meeting where John Deutsch, the deputy director of the CIA, is there, and this room is full of black parents who are furious because it's been uncovered that the CIA are involved in drug trafficking. And
Mike says, to remind us of that, CIA.
Now,
what Mike is saying, Martin,
likely that similar things were going on in Britain. And
what Mike is saying, Martin, let me just make it clear here, is that he was actually at South Central Los Angeles. He was a senior police officer there, and he is testifying in front of this public meeting and with the CIA boss there too, that the CIA is dealing drugs in this city. And he is a police officer saying this as a testimony. Well, it was quite sad because he committed suicide around about, I think it was probably 10 years ago now, but he made his mark, didn't he, while he was around still?
Well, Gary Webb, who was a journalist who investigated it all, he mysteriously committed suicide by shooting himself twice in the head, as you do. But in any case, as I say, there's a Hollywood film being made about all of this called Dark Alliance, and anybody can look into it. The Iran-Contra affair was really about cocaine importation into the United States, mainly from Colombia. But it was all being organized by the Contras in Nicaragua, who are basically a terrorist formation. And the Congress was Democrat-controlled at the time in the U.S., had forbidden the Reagan administration to supply them with weaponry. So they got round that by allowing them to deal drugs, which then gave them a slush fund to buy the necessary weaponry to overthrow the democratically elected government of Nicaragua, which was twice re-elected. And ultimately they succeeded by killing up to 30,000 people.
I mean, this isn't just about, it's not just about St. Paul's or any of the other minority ethnic communities around Britain. It's also about international drug smuggling. So it's a kind of double-edged sword, really. One, on the one hand, it's destroying political activism in these communities. And on the other hand, it's also raising vast sums of money for criminal black projects. Slush funds.
Yeah, and of course, it's got to remain illegal because otherwise it won't work. So all of the stuff about Reagan going, just say no, war on drugs, all of that. At the same time, people like Colonel Oliver North were involved in this drug dealing. And of course, Colonel Oliver North hasn't been to prison. He was pardoned for his role in all of this by George Bush Sr., because at the end of their term, presidents can pardon up to 200 people, whatever they've done, including murder. It's a pretty bizarre rule, but there it is. And of course, far from being regarded as a pariah, he is actually a great American hero, and he goes around to talk on TV and all the rest of it about the wonderful Reagan administration and his fantastic role in it all.
He talks to things like Pentecostal Christian services in great big halls and things like that.
That's right. But in actual fact, he's A, drug dealer, and B, a terrorist and a murderer. Now, you can see why people like Balagoon, when he gets attacked by Valentine, he doesn't go to the police. Nobody in Northern Ireland would go to the police either in those years for the same sort of reason.
Okay.
Now, things have changed since then, but that's how it was back then. And that's how certainly how people perceived it.
Well, things have changed, Martin. Maybe things have changed because of the fact that the very focused activism of St. Paul's has gone away. And that was that seemed to be the reason why the police were so hostile, or were persuaded to be so hostile and apparently racist in those days.
Well, look, frankly, the police back in Brixton when I lived in the 1980s were unprofessional racists. I won't put too fine a point on it.
Okay.
I saw loads of incidents where they were completely out of order. But, of course, they've learnt their lesson to some extent, because in actual fact, that provoked all of the uprisings and, burnings of the inner cities and so on. And they took a step back and thought, hang on a minute, we're losing control of this. And modern police claim to be... to have transcended that era. That's a claim.
Well, some claims
that there is no institutional racism in the Metropolitan Police.
Some will say that the drugs and the racist policing have now served its purpose.
Well, I'd say that in actual fact, the same things are still going on, and on a bigger scale. This was just the beginning of it all. The modern drugs industry is far bigger than it was back in those days.
Yeah.
And the CIA is still in it up to their eyeballs. In Afghanistan, the US planes fly from Afghanistan to Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo, which is the biggest US military base in Europe. And from there, drugs are distributed all throughout Europe. And, of course, loads of people know this. But, of course, we all pretend that the government's against drugs and we've just got to obey the police and everything will be all right.
Well, it sounds to me as if, we're dealing with organised crime at the very highest levels. But anyway, let's go now and have a listen to listen to Steve Norman. And this is an interview I did with Steve at the time, which I didn't air at the time, where he talks about his views on this whole business, including whether or not Valentine Walker was a police informer.
I got information from an ex-copper confirming that, it was well known that Valentine was in the pocket of some police. I got it in a text, well known that Valentine was in the hands of some coppers. The guy's story needs to be told.
It's the wrong story, Steve. It's the wrong story.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, Tim, the story's going to get out.
You sent me some press cuttings.
Balagoon sent them to me.
Oh, did he? Okay. Interesting, one of them was that where his archive was stolen of all the articles about him.
Yeah.
So they were trying even then to erase history. Somebody was.
My people are marvelling now as a direct result of what his dad done for the establishment. My conspiracy theorist. You're trying to tell me that Marvis was showing you loads of St. Paul's, and I'm Einstein.
Who was it that decided that he needed to be sent to Harvard?
It's payback time for your man, wasn't it? Marvin was 16, he was born in 72. All of a sudden, he's got his rise to the top, out of nowhere. He sits alongside Guildford Fuller, wherever he was sitting.
Well, yeah, same time, roughly, isn't it?
Well, it sits alongside it. It's a grave miscarriage of justice.
We need to make sure that wrong is righted.
I agree with you, whatever the cost, whatever price. I've had a number of conversations with him, and the guy bears no malice. He just wants the truth out there. You know, Andy Burkitt was his boss, didn't you?
He just wants the truth out there. Well, that's right. Balogun still does want the truth out there. So he's saying there, Martin, where Marvin, that's our present mayor, is now, is a direct result of what his dad did for the establishment. That's what Steve Norman is saying there. And he could be right, couldn't he, that Marvin sort of went onto this conveyor belt back when he was 15, 16 years old, to Harvard and places like that. And it looks as if the establishment were maybe rewarding Valentine Walker for his actions in closing down the anti-apartheid movement in St. Paul's.
Well, Marvin told me years ago about his father, and he also said that he had nothing to do with him for many years. He was brought up largely by his mother, who's a Welsh nursery teacher, and he was brought up spent a lot of his childhood in refuges, keeping away from Valentine. And in many ways, Marvin Rees has defined himself really as being against that kind of person. He's very highly educated. He was always a bright little boy. I know people who knew him when he was small, and he was always going to succeed despite the difficulties of his background. And what Marvin Rees himself has said, as you know, he doesn't particularly correspond with this program, but I mean, what he told me years ago, that he doesn't make it a secret that his dad is who he is. But on the other hand, he doesn't boast it from the rooftops either, because he doesn't actually have much to do with him. He's got a completely different family life. He's a churchgoer, and he's certainly nothing like his father.
OK, so let's have a listen now, finally, to another clip of Balogun, really talking about who he is now. Who is he? Who was he and who is he now? He's working in Ghana in the football world.
What people don't know is that I didn't actually know my parents. I didn't actually know my real parents. And my mother died when I was 9 months, and I didn't know my father. And basically, my roots were in West Africa. And I was fortunate enough to link up with some people after I was told what had actually happened, because this was kept from me for, 20-odd years. I didn't know the truth. And a lady I still know to be my mother, even though she's passed away, wasn't actually my mother. But God bless her soul, because she did her best for me. And I'm happy with what she's done, because she made me a very, very, very strong man. And so I was able to trace roots back to the Ashanti Kingdom, Nsuta Manpo. And that's where I went to stay. Having got there, I was a licensed coach. I'm a licensed football coach. I qualified at West Ham Football Club. And I'm also a level one and level two coach educator, a former referee as well. And so I came home and I thought, well, let me get involved in football. I was doing football, and because of, they say because I could articulate myself well in English, I also became a part of the media, and I'm considered one of the leading media personnel here in the country now. I've produced and directed my own television shows, radio shows. I've won awards for writing columns in newspapers and stuff like that. And so life just goes on. I'm in Ghana, and I'm doing what I like to do, and I'm fighting the challenges that are here too, because no matter where you go, you will find challenges, and there are a lot of challenges in Ghana.
Were you driven out of Bristol?
Yes, I was. I was driven out. I had to leave. First and foremost, I had so much hate mail as a result of linking up with Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA. I mean, mail was coming through my door that was addressed to the chief monkey, Monkeyville, St. Paul's, Bristol. The postman was delivering those type of mails through my door. And I've had, excrement come through the door, and lots of different threats. We're going to kill you. We're going to kill your wife. We're going to kill your kids. Lots of different things. And eventually it was decided that I had to leave Bristol. I didn't want to leave, but I had no choice, because it was quite clear that Valentine had tried to kill me. It wasn't successful. But there were going to be other attempts on my life. And so we had a caucus, especially within the Labour Party. And we did one or two things to ensure that I would get accommodation in London, that I would be employed in London. And so I left Bristol. And, I mean, you know, that was it.
I mean,
I've got no regrets about the whole thing. It's been a wonderful experience. I've learned a lot through the experience about myself, as much as I've learned about the institutions. I have no regrets at all about anything that has gone on in my life whatsoever. It's all played a significant part in my life, and it makes me who I am today.
Well, that's the voice of Balogun. Now, Nana Kwaku Angaman has changed his name. Anyway, I think it's quite nice, I think, Martin, to clear the air with this story, to do bring people up to date, I suppose, with the side of it which we weren't able to report at the time, simply because we didn't have the other side of the story. Now, we've at least made an attempt to speak to Valentine, and he hasn't given his side. At the end of the day, though, the bigger picture here, in a way, is that we're facing another apartheid, aren't we, at the moment, here in 2020, and that is Israeli apartheid. There doesn't really seem to be quite such a strong anti-apartheid campaign with the present issue. In fact, it's the opposite. The Israelis and the Israel lobby seems to be working very, very powerfully and closely and cleverly in order to shut down any kind of discussion or debate about Israel here.
Yeah, well, you'll find that the political regime in South Africa are not very happy about that. They've taken a consistently hostile stance to Israel's apartheid policies, and they basically see the two struggles as analogous. And of course, the propaganda wing of the Israeli state is much more sophisticated than the propaganda wing of apartheid South Africa. But ultimately, they're defending the indefensible, and there's going to be consequences. And the obvious consequences would be sanctions. And I think, it won't take much to push popular opinion all over the world into, if we're going to have sanctions on Russia for Crimea and sanctions on Iran for what they supposedly didn't do, why not sanctions on Israel? Why not? And of course, the answer is that the deep state in the West is utterly infiltrated by all of this. And, we're all being dragged by the nose into a potential world war. In some ways, the Israeli situation is far more dangerous than apartheid South Africa, which was a kind of residual colonial holdout. The Israelis are at the cutting edge of forcing us towards World War III.
I mean, we've heard a lot from Black Lives Matter, but not a lot from them about the Israeli apartheid.
Well, in actual fact, I mean, Black Lives Matter is a big amorphous movement. The idea that it's some kind of, they've got a line on anything. You've got different groups who say different things. But lots of people who are active in that have said, yes, we recognise the Israelis are an apartheid state, etc. And it's at that point that lots of the more mealy-mouthed, middle of the road site people started to walk away from Black Lives Matter. I mean, Palestinian Lives Matter. I mean, the Israeli snipers were shooting down the protesters outside, peaceful protesters trying to march out of the Gaza prison camp, and they've shot hundreds of them. That's each one of those is a George Floyd, you know.
Okay, so let's look at some other stories before we go on to look at COVID. Craig Murray this week, Martin, US, as an article in the United States, the CIA is obsessed with Craig Murray's upcoming testimony in the Assange case. Now, this, I think, is quite important because Craig Murray, the former ambassador to Uzbekistan, has been the most vehement supporter. And in fact, he's an extremely professional guy in that he was, for example, the top maritime lawyer at the Foreign Office for a while. And as a former ambassador, he's been very forensic and almost as a defense lawyer or a defense advisor to Assange. Apparently the CIA are obsessed with him. He himself, though, puts most of the blame on the British security services, and now he himself is being tried for contempt of court for commenting on the Alex Salmond case. But anyway, it seems to me as if, you know, there seems to be a focus on the Salmond case when really what this is about is persecuting an ongoing miscarriage of justice against Julian Assange.
Well, of course, it was Craig Murray who cooperated with WikiLeaks. He flew to the United States to take the memory stick, which had all of the internal emails of the DNC on it, the Democratic National Committee, which showed that they were deliberately rigging the primary system against Bernie Sanders. And in actual fact, I just read earlier, before we came on air, that Seth Rich, who was probably the leaker, he was the head of IT at the Democratic National Committee. He was not happy with the way things were going, and he was probably the leaker. And the court, which is investigating his murder, because he was murdered by a supposed robbery where they didn't take his phone or his wallet, there's some investigation going on into that. And the judge investigating that wants Julian Assange to testify about where they got these emails from, because it wasn't hacked by the Russians. It was stolen by an insider.
I mean, that does seem peripheral, Martin. That seems like a very peripheral to the actual case, whatever it is, an inquest or whatever they're doing in the United States over Seth Rich, because surely the judge's job there is just to look at the circumstances there. Murray's apparently also in this article, I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, the CIA obsessed with Craig Murray's upcoming testimony in the Assange case, just to come out this week. Murray had offered to give evidence to special counsel Robert Mueller, who spent $32 million of government money investigating a conspiracy between the Russian government and the Trump campaign, which came to nothing, and including the allegation that Russia hacked the Democratic National Committee computer and turned the emails from the DNC and John Podesta over to WikiLeaks, which published them. So the interesting thing here is Craig Murray's offered to give evidence to Robert Mueller, and Robert Mueller has simply just not even acknowledged that he sent him a letter, and he's not interested in hearing from Murray.
Well, WikiLeaks, Murray included, and Julian Assange, they know where those emails came from. And in actual fact, WikiLeaks offered a reward for any information relating to the death of Seth Rich. They haven't openly come out and said that's where they got it from, because one of the things, the ways WikiLeaks works, is that if you tell us stuff in confidence, we won't spill the beans about you. But of course, since Seth Rich is dead, spilling the beans about him won't do him any harm. And of course, ultimately, what this is we're dealing with high-level criminals who behave in criminal ways, who rig elections, and then when they get found out, they assassinate people.
But we're talking here, aren't we? We're talking here about Scotland too. So, you know, somebody is going after Craig Murray simply for reporting on the Alex Salmond trial, even though actually it seems to be a way of basically getting at him for other things he's done.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a court case in Spain at the moment where the Spanish authorities have arrested a Spanish security company because they got the contract from the CIA to bug the Ecuadorian embassy and get loads of inside information about both Craig Murray and Julian Assange. But they've been busted in Spain because you're not supposed to, because they were basically, you know, bugging things like Assange's discussions with his lawyers, which are supposed to be sacrosanct. But they're standing trial, and Murray is going to go to Spain to testify in that case. And
okay.
All of this skullduggery is all of a piece, and it's all linked together.
Okay, final story, or maybe final story, before we look at COVID on Serco, because there's a couple of scandals surrounding them, never mind all the scandals in the past where they've had to pay hundreds of millions of pounds in fines for lying, such as when they were being paid by the Home Office for thousands of people who were supposed to be on tags, even though their sentences had finished and they weren't on tags. Serco were being paid anyway. Worth mentioning that it's Rupert Soames, who's the chief executive of Serco, the brother of Nicholas Soames, who's the son of Sir Winston Churchill, former Tory Prime Minister. But also, Nicholas Soames is the guy that apparently phoned up Princess Diana and threatened her with her life before she died. But Rupert Soames' company, Serco, is involved in a couple of ways. First of all, in this contact tracing app and the contact tracing system, which seems to be roundly failing, but also with the housing of migrants across the town, across the country, and putting them up in hotels. So there is a suggestion by Nigel Farage, Martin, not your favourite person, but what he's saying here is this is a really a conflict of interest. What you've got is someone who's very close to the Conservative Party, who's actually standing to gain a fantastic amount through putting up asylum seekers who then come across and economic migrants, and there's no prospect of them going home. So this may be why we've seen these waves and waves, something like 3,000 since the beginning, or 4,000 since the beginning of the lockdown, of illegal migrants being ferried by the mafia across the channel into the UK, straight into the hands of Serco, and money going into the coffers of Rupert Soames.
Yeah, but you've got to distinguish between refugees and asylum seekers and economic migrants. Some people who come in across the channel probably are economic migrants, others are not. They're coming from war zones. Now, that's a separate issue. What's clearly going on is this is a government of crony capitalists. Loads and loads of the coronavirus crisis has given a huge opportunity for government to hand out contracts, millions of dollars of contracts, billions of pounds of contracts, to mates with no competitive
tender. Yeah, actually, Craig Murray
on the basis that it's an emergency and they haven't got time.
Well, that's right. Craig Murray has pointed this out too, hasn't he? Craig Murray pointed this out, that we've also got we've also had a face mask contract being handed to a friend of the Conservative Party, and those face masks are proving many of them proving inadequate.
Yep, and of course you've got Robert Jenks, who's now the housing minister, who says he's going to rip up the planning regulations brought in by the Labour government in 1945 to get the economy moving again, of course. But just incidentally, it means that Richard Desmond, for example, was going to be given a permission to build his luxury flats complex in Tower Hamlets and avoid paying $20 million towards local infrastructure. This particular Conservative government is a government of spivs. They always were spivs, but these people really are the bottom of the barrel.
Okay, well, let's just go north of the border now to Aberdeen, where there's been this Aberdeen cluster, they call it, and a lockdown in Aberdeen. The interesting figures around this, I think, are to do with this place called the Hawthorne Bar in Holborn Street in Aberdeen. The pub said the outbreak was linked to customers who visited on the 26th of July. There are 13 new cases. None of them are showing anything more than no symptoms or mild symptoms after having been tested, but the whole town has been locked down. There are no deaths been reported in Scotland with any coronavirus for 3 weeks, and yet Aberdeen is being locked down. So let's have a listen now to Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, announcing this lockdown earlier this week.
And I can confirm that it was agreed at SCOR this morning, albeit, as I'm sure you understand, extremely reluctantly, to reimpose some restrictions on the Aberdeen city area. And I want to set out what those restrictions are. Though let me remind you, because I know particularly for people living in Aberdeen, there will be lots of questions, that we will make more detail available over the course of the day to give as much clarity to people as possible. But firstly, our travel guidance to people in Aberdeen from today is that you should no longer travel more than 5 miles for leisure or recreational purposes. You may continue to travel for work or education, but we advise against other travel. We're also advising people who are not in Aberdeen not to travel to Aberdeen. If you are already in Aberdeen visiting family or on holiday, you can stay. But please follow all of the guidance while you're there and take extra care when you return home. Secondly, from today, people in Aberdeen should not go into each other's houses. Extended household groups can continue, but remember, these are situations which should only involve one other adult who is living on their own. And finally, we will be introducing regulations. We will publish these later today, requiring all indoor and outdoor hospitality in the city to close by 5 p.m. today. That includes all bars, restaurants, cafes and pubs. Hotel restaurants can remain open, but to provide food for residents only, and takeaway services can continue, but all other pubs and restaurants and cafes must close. This restriction on hospitality will be backed by regulation, so if necessary, it will be enforced. But I would expect, given the responsible way they have behaved in recent days, the owners of these businesses in Aberdeen will act voluntarily and continue to be responsible. And I want to thank businesses in the hospitality trade for their cooperation so far.
So that's First Minister of Scotland and Nicola Sturgeon there announcing this extra lockdown in Aberdeen. There's an element of absurdity to this, Martin, because nobody is actually ill in Aberdeen.
Yeah, but we know that there is asymptomatic transfer of the virus. So if you're going to I mean, what they're going for in Scotland is zero virus, just like they've got in New Zealand. What they're going for in England is minimising the virus.
Journalist Peter Hitchens says the most common symptom of COVID-19 is that you feel just fine. Huge numbers of those now being absurdly listed as infected with this bogeyman disease are perfectly healthy. If the trained hunters of the government's National Panic Service had not tracked them down, most of them would never have known they were supposed to be ill. Why do we take this seriously? It's a fact, not a conspiracy theory, that the power of the state is now being used to keep us in conditions of perpetual alarm. We're ceaselessly threatened with a second wave, for which there is, in fact, no evidence. So there is an element here, Martin, of something rather absurd and bizarre, where no longer is there any interest in people either being ill or dying from this disease. Just the very fact that a disease might be there, and there are questions about these tests, which we'll hear about in a minute, whether they're actually delivering false positives. It sounds to me as if it's becoming more and more difficult for people to trust what this government are saying.
Which government, the Scottish government or the English government?
Either.
Well, Peter Hitchens, as you well know, is an opinionated right-wing journalist. He's got his views. Nicola Sturgeon
just a minute. You can't just say that. He's absolutely quite correct when he says the most common symptom of COVID-19 is that you feel fine. Most of the people who have apparently got this disease have absolutely no symptoms at all.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things we don't understand about this disease, about how far it's spread through the community, about what the death rate is compared to infection rates. And basically, some countries have taken a safety first policy, like New Zealand, like Scotland. Other countries like England, where Peter Hitchens' party, the Conservative Party, runs the country, have taken a more laissez-faire
attitude.
Well,
he's one of their biggest critics.
Well, he is and he isn't, Tony. I'm not going to argue about what his politics are. I mean, on some things like Syria, I agree with him, but a stop clock is right twice a day. The fact is, there's going to be an objective test of all of this, because we've got different policies being pursued in different countries, and we're going to see different outcomes. And then there's going to have to be an inquiry in Britain into what went wrong here, because some things clearly did go wrong, like they didn't lock down quick enough, and that there's possibly tens of thousands of people who would be alive if they had. And there's going to be an inquiry like the Iraq War inquiry. And, of course, lots of Tories. I mean, if you read Andrew Rawnsley in The Observer this week, he's saying Boris Johnson is now getting very, very frightened of a second spike in England because it could well have his head on it.
The idea of tens of thousands of people dying, that may also have been prevented with the use of chloroquine. It might also have been prevented if the government had advised people to be getting people to take zinc, vitamin D and vitamin C in order to boost their immune system. But one of the main things you talk about, Martin, is you don't think that there will be a vaccine. The fact is that there are quite a lot under preparation, and some of them are rather sinister. I talked to Dr. Judith Brown this week about the DNA altering vaccines which are under preparation.
Ordinary people feel very concerned about the vaccine. First of all, of course, it changes your DNA, and that's going to be a permanent change.
But surely most vaccines don't do that, do they?
No, this is the first one. They actually inject an RNA, and in addition to the RNA strand, they have a substance that they call M that they We don't know what that is, that they attach to the RNA strand, and that's the basis of the vaccine. But we don't actually know what M is, and presumably it's M that attaches to your DNA.
Okay, that's well, can you just explain in what way that vaccine is different to, say, some ordinary vaccine like the old measles vaccine used to be?
Well, what you normally get is maybe a dead virus or an altered virus that's injected into your body, and that causes you to have an antibody response to that particular substance. But the difference in this is that it actually genetically modifies the human body so that the human body then has an ability to manufacture antibodies if it comes across the coronavirus in the future.
So is that your blood or chromosomes get changed, your whole body?
Your whole body, yeah, which is quite amazing.
So it goes through every cell and changes the chromosome?
Every cell. The whole body will be genetically modified.
So how does that help?
Well, they say that it'll stop people from getting coronaviruses, but and then they say that you might even need a booster. Of course, they're also talking about it being injected with a completely different form of injection that we haven't seen before. That's instead of having one needle, it's got sort of like a little pad of tiny needles, and included in that is a sort of like a tattoo, which isn't visible to the naked eye. But there are certain apps that you can have on your phone that actually they can shine on your arm to see whether you've had the vaccination or not. I think the other things that people are worried about in terms of the vaccine, the fact that it's a DNA vaccine, so therefore it has to be manufactured from somewhere, from human cells. And they're using human embryonic cells in order to manufacture it, because that it isn't the first vaccine where they've actually used embryonic cells, but they are using them in a completely different way. Some people are very worried about that, especially people who've got a particular religious position.
We're talking about a society being separated into two classes of people, those who've had the vaccine and those who have decided not to.
Yeah. Yes, I think personally that the vaccine isn't going to be mandated, but there's going to be so much coercion. For example, they're going to say that you can't travel on aeroplanes unless they can prove that you've had the vaccine. You can't maybe go into shops, virtually restricting people to house arrest if they don't have a vaccine. And I think that unless there is a massive protest against that, I think that that it's going to be very difficult to resist.
So that's Dr. Judith Brown. She's not a medical doctor, but she did work for many years as a nurse. And she then went out to work over in Yemen for the United Nations. Martin, that is just one of these new types of vaccines that they're talking about here, one that alters your DNA, hopefully enabling your cells to better fight the virus, the coronavirus, which, of course, you know, it's worth mentioning. These coronaviruses have been around time immemorial. From the common cold types, but the medical profession still never found any kind of vaccine to the coronavirus. Generally, would you trust the government if the various regulators say that this virus is safe if it does appear on the scene?
You mean vaccine, not virus?
Yeah.
Well, the question is, with all of these things, is who guards the guardians? Basically, as we know, Big Pharma in the West is driven by profit and massive profit at the same at that, all based around intellectual property rights for research that they've conducted, often with funding from governments. I mean, governments have been chucking loads of money at this problem, as you can imagine, but they've given it in the West to private sector companies who will then own the vaccines that they create. And of course, the whole setup is completely open to corruption of all kinds. And it's quite possible that they do want to have everybody chipped with these vaccines, even if there's nothing in the vaccine, because you've then created a kind of chip society that you can manipulate. But of course, at the same time as we're saying this, both the Cubans and the Chinese and others, the communists, if you like, are trying to develop a vaccine which they say they will give away if they develop one, and they won't have any, you know, and there won't be any material interest involved in it at all. Now, ultimately, as a socialist, I would say that we've got to regulate all of these things and the regulators have got to have teeth, and they've got to be able to, and in actual fact, the case for nationalization, in other words, socialization of the creation of medicine, is overwhelming. What real interest does the private sector have in running this? Something like an epidemic like this just brings home how interdependent human society is. There's no way that we can all operate independently in face of these kind of threats. And therefore, we need collective health provision. And the countries that have done well in so far in this crisis have, in fact, been those with a socialist system, including Kerala in southern India, which has been run by the Communist Party of India since the 40s. And of course, they've got low level medical personnel operating in all of their rural communities. And the same true in Cuba. Venezuela has done very well. So has Nicaragua. The places have done very badly are places like South Africa, where although you've got a left-wing government, they haven't got much power. And, of course, in Brazil, where Bolsonaro still denies that there's anything going on as the bodies pile up.
Including Sweden, which didn't lock down at all.
Well, as I said earlier, Tony, we're going to get a very good experiment here. Lots of different countries have adopted different policies, and we're going to be able to look through all of it and see who's done well and who's done badly. The countries that have done very well.
Will you be taking this virus when it comes along? This virus?
You mean vaccine? It depends on what it is and who's offering it. I still have my doubts whether you can get a vaccine for a common cold. We've not, as you said earlier, they've been looking for a vaccine for the common cold for decades, and they haven't found it. We haven't found a vaccine for HIV.
Okay, well, either. let's go now and have a look at censorship around this whole issue. And we heard last week from Robin Campbell, who's an IT consultant here in Bristol, and I went to see him this week where he told me about the censorship of his YouTube channel after he put up an interview with a medical doctor, Dr. Mohammed Adil, who was subsequently struck off. Well, in fact, he was struck off for literally criticizing government policy on the virus. Now, this is a particularly horrific thing, I think, to happen, because we need our doctors to be able to feel free to speak their mind about this, because, as we know, we need to have a second opinion for our own situations with medical issues. And of course, that needs to happen too. With the pandemic, and the idea that you're intimidating doctors to take the government line is particularly frightening. So let's have a listen now to Robin Campbell talking about what happened to his YouTube channel.
I'd either just upload a great interview with a doctor, or I would go off and check out, do some research myself. For instance, I did one on the VSTS Enterprises from Manchester, who seemed to get the gig for contact tracing. I went onto the company's house, looked at their history, and put together a small 10-minute video on who are these people, why are they getting the gig. They seemed to have their software ready in March, got awarded, I think it was 28 million quid's worth of contract back in the end of March or early April, when contract tracing was hardly in anyone's mind. That seemed preemptive to me and worthy of exposing. So I did some of my own videos, uploaded some. I was doing interviews with people, and someone recommended I talk to Dr. Adil from Oldham, who's 35 years in the business, and he was a cancer surgeon, and I was recommended I talk to him. And at this stage, I'd learned how to live stream, do all the bits and bobs online, and he agreed to come on. We did a two-hour interview where he shared all of the science, all of the principles of treating viruses. He went through all of his concerns, particularly in the world of cancer treatment and lots of patients missing their treatments. He also went into disparaging strategy on care homes worldwide, not just in the UK, where the infected were being thrown straight into care homes, essentially throwing a hand grenade into that care home. And also his concern about big business and the Gates Foundation, WHO directives, CDC corruption, the vaccine industry being completely dominant in all policy, it seemed. And also just human freedoms and civil liberties. Doctor's a very moral person. He runs a charity and institution like a university in Pakistan, which is a bit like a feeder university into the UK. So he spreads health and wealth. That's a very honourable thing to be doing. Very highly esteemed where he worked and amongst that community. And when the video was published and released, it took 48 hours for YouTube to terminate my channel. Now, for those that have a channel, you'll know that normally you get a deletion warning or you get a strike. And typically up to perhaps January this year, you would have had 3 strikes and you're out rule. Well, that didn't apply to my channel. I didn't have any strikes. I had some videos deleted for community guidelines because they went against the mainstream narrative. And I had no recourse, no right to do anything about my channel. It just went. So I didn't stop, though. I just got going again. And then I interviewed Dr. Adil's friend as well.
How many videos did you have on the channel when it was deleted?
I had 313, 80 gigabytes worth of hard work.
And how many hits had the Dr. Adil interview had?
It's hard to say. I think it was pushing up over 40-odd thousand.
So that's the discussion with Robin Campbell, Martin, about this sort of form of censorship is where we seem to be edging towards the China levels of censorship, where one thought that there was an ability and an interest in what doctors were saying about this, but apparently not. And in fact, I remember right at the very beginning being told by NHS staff that they were being effectively threatened. Do not speak to the press at all about anything to do with the pandemic or anything to do with your job. Otherwise, you will never work again.
Yeah, well, it's on the face of it, a quite disturbing story. I think the YouTube channel stuff, I mean, basically, YouTube is a private organisation and they can do anything they like.
Well, one
and
of the most.
It is censorship, but it's
one of the most worrying things.
They don't want to put your stuff up there. There's not a lot you can do about it. You can try and find another mechanism for circulating your videos. The striking off of a doctor for speaking out, that disturbed me more. And I'd like to know what the justification for that was, because it sounds to me as if that's completely disproportionate.
But it's two aspects, isn't it, Martin? It's two aspects to demonising somebody for their views. Number one, stopping their professional career, and number two, gagging them, making it impossible for people at the moment to hear what he's got to say.
Yeah, well, as you know, Tony, YouTube have got plenty of techniques for silencing things they don't like. The same is true of Twitter. Any of these platforms, don't forget, they are money-making exercises, and they're embedded with the deep state, and they're embedded with the pharmaceutical
company.
Well,
certainly Google is, isn't it? Yeah. And we know that there are very, very close ties between the parent company of YouTube, Google, and the National Security Agency, for example. But anyway, let's listen to a second clip with Robin, because I thought it'd be interesting to ask him. I mean, he has lots to say about how almost all the media now is becoming incredibly toxic here in the West. You know, really coming up alongside the sort of thing we've seen in China, the mass censorship in China. So the idea that the West is a bastion of free speech is being thrown down the toilet. And also asked him about what he thinks that, if there's any kind of exit strategy for this situation that we're in now.
I've been chatting about this with my wife, the fact that the mainstream media is so toxic at the moment. You either become a slave because you've watched too much of it, or you turn it off and go and find something more reliable. Equally, I find it staggering that there's been no sessions in Parliament. Where is the Labour Party challenging what's being done? Why isn't there any pushback right now to what Boris and the Tories are up to? Where's the Labour Party? Where are they?
Well, it's because there's a pandemic going on. This might happen afterwards.
This totalitarian creep is marching on at a pace. And if we don't push back and if we don't shine the light on this pervasive control of the narrative, then we are at risk. So I think we're at risk of losing those liberties.
So why do you say totalitarian? I mean, surely the situation is we're in a pandemic. The government has got to enforce lockdown or measures to stop it.
Yeah, and I thought that for the first 2 weeks in March. But then when it was 2 weeks had gone. We're now into protecting the NHS. We built the Nightingale hospitals. We got into April. That seemed to be achieved. No cases in Bristol. You know, hospitals empty. Waiting lists down at 13 in Bath, for instance. Nightingale hospitals empty. Doctors and nurses being laid off. I thought that's time to release this lockdown and get on with business. But oh no, the lockstep document written by the Rockefeller Foundation itemizes this strategy worldwide, as if you go on the World Economic Forum, you'll see this huge mind map, which was up there ready with COVID-19 marked on it early March. And people pointed this out. It seemed to be a completely done deal with very, very nuanced and layered strategies going into all aspects of our lives. So if you had the, if you had that awareness back in March, you could see it was coming. But it's like talking to people around you is quite a challenge because they don't have that 360 view on things, nor do they have this, this inbuilt innate mistrust of what's coming out of their goggle box. And they don't realize there's a lot of propaganda going on and brainwashing.
So look, you're painting a picture of masses of humanity being herded around like animals. What's the actual, do you have an exit strategy from this?
I can tell you, I belong to a very thriving community and there's lots of people wanting to just get out, you know, off-grid communities. I'm actually helping an off-grid community in Bristol called Eco Villages, which aims to get off-grid completely. And I think that's a viable option now, just to get out from any of this city-dwelling, Agenda 21-type, high-density city life.
That's Robin Campbell again there. Martin, there is it's quite obvious that for many people, they're just simply trusting. I mean, you said a few weeks ago, you know, the BBC have come out very well out of this. There's another point of view, which is that people are switching off their TVs. People are switching off from the mass media. They simply don't trust what they're being told, particularly with the pandemic over, actually cases that basically down to zero of people who are seriously ill or dying in many parts of the country. And yet the methods of control seem to be ramping up.
All right. Well, I'm not necessarily going to agree with you that we're down to zero. And don't forget the obvious argument from the establishment point of view.
Well, OK, can I just say one thing, Martin, about this zero? Is there have been no fatalities for COVID-19 in Scotland for nearly a month now?
Yes, and that's the way they want to keep it, Tony.
And yet, what they're trying to do is lock down cities like Aberdeen.
Well, that's a decision for the Scottish government. You'll have to take it up with them. Can I just mention, if we're talking about conspiracies, the Times of Israel said that the US Defense Intelligence Agency told them in November that there was going to be a pandemic coming out of China. Now, in other words, somebody, not in March, in November, knew there was a pandemic coming out of China. And I'm quite sure that the Chinese intelligence services and the Russian intelligence services, we had that guy from the GRU on some weeks ago saying, well, we think this is a biological warfare attack on China. Now, if it's a biological warfare attack, it's not just made up, is it?
No, it certainly isn't. No one's saying that. But what I am saying most clearly here is that there is a absurd situation where many of the methods of dealing with this situation are increasing just as the cases are falling down to zero in Scotland.
Well, as I say, you'll have to take that up with the Scottish government.
All right, Martin.
Don't forget they are elected.
That reply
and
already.
In actual fact,
anyhow,
if you look at the opinion polls, Tony, you will see that the Scottish population are far happier with Nicola Sturgeon than the English population
Let's see. I don't believe those. I think we'll see if there's an election.
You know, believe them or not, but there they are.
Yeah. Let's see if there's an election, how well Nicola Sturgeon
does.
There's
an election coming up next May.
I mean,
they're looking as if they're going to win. I don't think anybody assumes anything else. They're definitely going to win.
She's obviously been intimately involved in this prosecution of Alex Salmond and the subsequent prosecution of Craig Murray, having centralised all police power into one person's hands in the whole of Scotland from all the individual forces. But let's have a listen now to Dr. Mohammed Adil. This is the guy that's been struck off, who I spoke to earlier this week, because one of the most important things at the moment, are these tests, because the tests are now causing, even if you don't have any symptoms, and some individual specific places are being tested through contact tracing. People are being told to come and get tested, or they're even having tests sent to them and being sent back. And so what we're doing is we're closing down cities and towns and regions based on the results of these tests, based on the Serco, unreliable Serco's contact tracing system. But how reliable are the tests themselves? I thought I'd ask Dr. Mohammed Adil, who's been struck off, that question.
The tests are not reliable at all. I don't know. The various tests are coming up into the test and tracing and all sort of fancy things are going on. And there's a commercial advertisement on the BBC sort of TV, which is international fame, with a different instrument they are showing to the public that this is an instrument which can test 15,000 patients in an hour. This is what okay. For example, if this is a test kit, what is going to mean by somebody who is a normal person like myself or yourself and all the children, if they got test positive, what does it mean? Do they need an isolation? The answer is no. Do they need to stop work? The answer is no. Do they need to not to see their parents or the grandparents? The answer is they should see them. There is no indication anybody being test positive should be isolated and be locked down into the home or into the cage. That is not an indication. That is causing serious problems.
So they could pass the disease on to someone else.
No, this is the fear they have generated, actually. That, you know, I go to the shopping center, I go to the shops, and I'm surprised to see the people, they're wearing masks. 80% people are wearing masks in the shopping center without having any clue that what the mask is going to damage to their body internally. They've got a mask on their face, they're not able to even breathe, and they are recirculating, rebreathing their carbon dioxide. And they're not having fresh air at all, and that is causing more damage.
So that's Dr. Mohammed Adil there. Martin's saying two things. This is the what you get struck off for nowadays is a second opinion. Saying two things. First of all, he doesn't believe that the masks are effective, that actually what you're doing is you're re-inhaling the same air again and again, which can be a problem, can allow actually viruses to build up in there. And also saying that the tests are simply not reliable enough.
Well, I mean, the question of whether the tests are reliable enough or not, that's a definite question. Because obviously, if you're using duff tests, then you're not going to get the results you want. But I have to say that in the countries which have had a good COVID war, the ones I was mentioning earlier, including the People's Republic of China, they isolated everybody who tested positive. They didn't just say go home. They provided them with premises for which to go and self-isolate, and they paid their wages and stuff like that. So they took it. That's what they did at the very beginning of the crisis. And of course, as I stressed earlier, the Times of Israel said that the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States tipped off the Israeli Defense Forces that something like this was coming in November. But of course, the Chinese got on the program. The Kerelans got on the program. The New Zealanders got on the program, and they've managed to largely evade this virus. Whereas, of course, in the US and Britain, it's run amok. And of course, it has to run amok in the US because the financial system started collapsing in September, as we heard the other week from our Croatian friend. And of course, at that point, they need to have a distraction from the collapse of the financial system. And seeding a biological weapon in China fits the bill.
What about all those people that have not been treated because of this? Now, we're hearing this as a statistic I mentioned last week, which is though 45,000 people or so have had COVID-19 on their death certificate. So, in other words, they died with COVID-19, not of COVID-19, the total for the lockdown is looking like something like 200,000. That is to say, for example, cancer patients and other patients that simply weren't treated and so died prematurely.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying I've got all the answers to any of this. We're all struggling in the dark. But the counter argument would be, if you don't lock down, then you're going to have more deaths from COVID-19. If you do lock down, you have more deaths from other stuff. And of course, if you get it right, you minimise deaths from both, which is exactly
Kerala. Martin, how does the shutting down of the National Health Service's normal activities fit in with all this?
Well, that's an issue in countries that have a health service. But don't forget, lots of countries like the United States of America say you're going to cut down the health service.
You know what I'm talking about. Haven't got any health.
They say you should talk to your ordinary doctor.
Martin,
most
you know what I'm talking
US
about.
Got a doctor.
I'm not talking about countries with no health service. I'm talking about the UK.
Yeah, well, but there's going to be an inquiry into all of this, Tony, and whether they did the right things at the right time. But in New Zealand, where they locked down early, they're out of lockdown now. We're not out of lockdown because we missed up when
okay,
the bus was
finally, let's just look at the – there's this – I mean, something I think sounded to me totally absurd, which is the discussion that apparently you may be able to open pubs or schools, but not both. You've got to decide, you know. So if you open the pubs up, the schools have got to close. If you open the schools up, the pubs have got to close. Now, this just seems absurd to me when you've got death rates banging around zero. And we've never in the world's history ever had quarantining and restrictions for people who are not actually showing any symptoms or in any way ill. You've never had people who have been not ill.
Quarantine was in Venice originally. They invented it. Any ship coming into Venice, the people had to wait on an island outside Venice for 40 days, whether they'd shown any symptoms or not. That's because they were worried about plague.
And what was that,
year after year.
Was that in medieval times?
Yes.
Okay, so maybe it's never been done for hundreds of years. And, of course, Venice was a totalitarian city-state.
No, it was an oligarchy like the modern oligarchies. I mean, if you're going to talk historical facts, Tony, you've got to get the historical facts right rather than just painting.
I mean, I have actually got that historical fact right.
Quarantine was for everybody coming in, whether they showed any symptoms. There's an island where they used to put them.
Martin, you just said that. You know, actually, what we're saying here is, in fact, you've made your argument for me, is that it's only in a totalitarian oligarchic state that this kind of thing could happen.
These are public health measures which were adopted because they didn't really understand disease. They took a precautionary approach. That's pretty much what most sensible governments have done in relation to this. And, of course, the IDF, as I said earlier, were warned in November that it was coming. And, of course, there'll be questions in Israel. Why didn't we do anything about it since we've been told in November that this was coming? And, of course, the question is, how did the Defence Intelligence Agency of the United States know that something was coming in November? That's a question, isn't it?
Okay, just
like
looking
at the Twin Towers.
Just looking at the national NHS figures, we're now looking at something like 5 people a day dying with COVID-19, not of COVID-19. So, I mean, I'm surprised that we've got any kind of measures whatsoever because this seems a very extreme measure. Now it seems like we've pretty much achieved herd immunity here in Britain, and that young people are not going to be circulating this disease simply because they've already had it and a very mild sense.
What's going to happen now is going to be interesting, isn't it? Different countries are pursuing different strategies in relation to releasing lockdown. But I think it's pretty clear, even in the countries that have done well, like Germany, that when you release the lockdown, the damn thing comes back, which is what you'd expect, isn't it? Just logically.
Yeah, Neil Ferguson, I thought we'd seen the last of him. He was the guy that is funded by the Gates Foundation, who was responsible for triggering the lockdown by basically scaring the government into thinking there was going to be 500,000 people die of COVID-19, not with COVID-19. As it actually turned out, the total number of people who died of COVID-19 and nothing else is around about 1,300. So he was about 500 or 400 or so times out on that. He's been saying this week, finally, Martin, that the R number may rise if secondary schools reopen.
Well, it's pretty likely that it will. I mean, you're arguing what are essentially counterintuitively. Most people realise that we don't really know what this virus is. We've got people like us talk about the conspiracies of biological warfare. Most people don't go into it in that sort of detail. They just take what the government says and says, OK, this is potentially dangerous. We're going to listen to what they're saying. Now, you've got to have a very good reason to say that's all nonsense.
Well, I'll tell you why. Martin, you just asked for a good reason. I'll tell you the good reason. And that is to say that we're now talking about cases, most of which, in fact, almost all of which are asymptomatic rather than anybody actually even getting ill.
But the point about the asymptomatic cases, this is, didn't you see Boris Johnson saying we didn't know about asymptomatic cases when we put all of these people from the hospitals into the care homes? They weren't showing any symptoms, so we just presumed they were all right. They should have been tested, and what the tests would have shown that they weren't all right. And that's the whole point about this disease. There's some incubation period. We're not quite sure what it is. Well, you don't show any symptoms. Well, some people are infectious, but don't show any symptoms.
Just a minute.
It's like Typhoid Mary, who killed loads of people in New York back in the 19th century.
You're just factually inaccurate there, because right at the start, it was realised from China that there was the Chinese told the world that there's a 2-week incubation period. So the idea.
Yes, but Boris Johnson tried to get out of responsibility for moving people from the hospitals.
Because
he said, oh, we didn't know. They did know, as you've just pointed out.
They knew.
But they did it anyway.
At least we agree on that. Anyway, we'll be talking about Beirut after some music.
This is Layabout.
Well, I'm a layabout. A full-time layabout. I want to be a layabout.